Jason for being invited to have a part in this particular discussion forum as well. I appreciate the invitation to speak on this particular subject, and I appreciate the invitation to speak on the same forum with Edward Fudge. I have read his writings over the years, have appreciated much of what he has written, have utilized his articles, commentary on Hebrews and various things that he has written over the years that have made me come to appreciate him as truly one who is interested in what the Bible says. And though we disagree on this particular topic, I would not for a moment imagine that Brother Fudge would at any time be dishonest with the Scriptures. And I want to make that clear to you and also to him. I believe a person can hold a false position without knowing that it is false. And I believe that that's the case on this occasion with Brother Fudge, that he has attempted to understand the Scriptures in the best possible way. I think, though, that he has made some very serious mistakes. And I hope that we will have time to cover some of those. The timekeeper is relentless. And as you can tell, Brother Fudge was unable to finish his material. I may be unable to finish mine. And we'll just have to wait and see how it turns out. Brother Fudge mentioned that the traditional view started in the 4th century. I would like to point out that his position started in the 3rd century. And that what he calls the traditional position, I believe, is the biblical position, and that it started not only in the 1st century, but even before, back in the Old Testament times, when inspiration first wrote some words upon the sacred page. Origen was the name of a theologian who lived in the 3rd century, and he denied the doctrine of eternal torment, and I believe is the father of this denial. You come down through the centuries, and I'm not going to take the time to present anything much from the Reformation period, except just to say that it was the Anabaptists and the Socinians who were noted for their denial of eternal torment. And really, when you come to the situation of someone saying there is no eternal torment, you have basically just two categories of people. You have the universalists, and there have been those who have espoused that view. They are mainly identified with the Unitarian Universalist Church, but not altogether. And there have been books, a number of books, written by universalists or restorationists who believe that everyone is going to be saved, or eventually everyone is going to be saved, or come back out of the torments of hell, or come back out of a purgatory, or some such thing as that. Our brother here on the platform with me does not hold that view. But he does hold a view that is rather similar to two other groups that are more familiar to us, and that is the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Seventh-day Adventists. Now, he will be quick to say that he does not agree entirely with either one of those, and I'm aware of that. The Jehovah's Witnesses teach that there is no torment at all. They say that the incorrigibly wicked simply will never be resurrected, and that others who are resurrected to have a second chance and so forth, in their second chance doctrine, in their millennial views, they believe that at the end of time, those wicked, at the final judgment, are simply going to be snuffed out of existence just in one moment of time, and that's the end of them. The Seventh-day Adventists are a little bit different. They believe that everyone is going to be raised, and that a person will suffer a period of torment, however short or however long his sins deserve. And they say that since Satan is the most wicked one of all, then he will naturally be the last one to perish and finally go out of existence. Now, Brother Fudge, from my reading of his book, holds a view very similar to that, although he would not necessarily agree with them on the end of Satan. But he does apparently agree with them on the end of mankind in just about every point that I'm able to determine, and therefore would hold a view almost identical with the Seventh-day Adventist view. A view is not necessarily wrong just because some group holds to it. And this view, I would not say is wrong simply because a denominational group that is known to have various other errors holds to that view. But I want us to know where we're coming from and what exactly it is that we're holding to, and what his position is and what the position that I'm defending is. I believe that when we go back to the material that we have in the Bible, we can see that all of this does not hold any water at all. I'm going to begin by presenting some material that is represented in the book, and some of the things that Brother Fudge has said I'm going to reserve until the second segment, the 15-minute rebuttal, in order to perhaps better cover it at that time. But let us point out here at the beginning that hell is something that finds its real definition in the New Testament, not in the Old. The Old Testament does not have much to say about the eternal existence of anyone. You stop and count up the passages that you can think of in the Old Testament that speak of the end of either the righteous or the wicked. Either one, and you will see very readily that the Old Testament does not have much to say on the subject. The word hell comes to us from the Greek. It is a translation. The English word is a translation from the Greek word gehenna, which itself was a sort of a transliteration, of a loose transliteration from the Aramaic expression gehenna, Aramaic being similar to Hebrew. And because the second word began with an H, it is commonly represented, transliterated into English, the word gehenna, commonly represented as having H in it. And so people spell it gehenna, or pronounce it gehenna, and spell it with an H. And this is the word that is found 12 times in the New Testament. 11 of these recorded instances are from the lips of Jesus. And it does refer to an actual place in the Old Testament time. There was a valley south of Jerusalem. And this valley had a very notorious history. In fact, at one period of time when the children of Israel had gone into idolatry, predominantly during the time of Ahaz and Manasseh, they offered their children to the god Moloch or Molech, and they were actually burned with fire in that valley. Josiah, the great reformer of Judah, came along and defiled that place in his overthrow of idolatry. He placed some human bones there. It became a place of defilement, a place of abhorrence. Jeremiah later on offered some prophecies regarding that place and predicted that there was going to be some terrible judgments against Jerusalem. And there would be a lot of dead bodies strewn around in the place called the Valley of Hinnom. And so that's a little bit of the background. This is the term that Jesus used. Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom, combined together into that word Gehenna, which is in the Greek New Testament and is translated hell in our common versions. This is the term that Jesus used. And he did use a term that was already in existence. He did not coin the term. It had already been in existence by the Jews in time past. And yet Jesus used it, a term that had a specific location, that had temporal connotations in the Old Testament time, but he used it with eternal ramifications. I'm not going to say more just now about the prevailing view of the Jews. I disagree with Brother Fudge on that. And I hope that in the second period, time will allow me to present to you some evidence showing that the prevailing view of the Jews between the Testaments was not that there was no eternal torment. And also, therefore, that Jesus' hearers, when they heard that word hell, they understood that he was talking about something that did pertain to eternal torment. And that Jesus was dealing, therefore, with a term that would be understood by them as having eternal consequences and an eternal unending existence. Let's notice, though, quickly what Jesus said about the description of hell. In Mark 9, verse 43 and 48, you read about unquenchable fire, and you read about the place where the worm died not and the fire is not quenched. Jesus did use a metaphor that is also found, a double metaphor, in fact, it is also found in Isaiah 66, 24, as Brother Fudge has already pointed out. But I want to suggest to you that Jesus' use of the term is not the same as the use of the term in the Old Testament. That Jesus was not referring to a literal temporal punishment, as was the case in Isaiah 66, but that he was referring to eternity, and this had nothing to do with what the passage in Isaiah 66 was referring to. That was a restoration prophecy. It had to do with people coming back out of captivity. It had to do with Israel coming back into the land of promise. It was a prophecy whereby God was saying that the righteous of Israel would be in triumph over their enemies, who would then be punished because of their sins. And in eternity, therefore, we're going to have to go back, go beyond Old Testament meanings. And here Jesus used a term that does have an Old Testament background, but he used it with a New Testament meaning. He wasn't talking about temporal punishment. He was talking about something that would last forever and ever. The word Gehenna does therefore not refer to that literal valley of Hinnom. And when Jesus mentioned the worm and fire, he was dealing with eternity. He was not dealing with temporal punishment. And therefore, he was talking about what's going to happen to the soul and the resurrection body, not the mortal, physical, temporal bodies such as you and I have today. We're going to have to notice that Jesus gave not only that description, but he also went ahead to give another description, which Brother Fudge also pointed out, and that is the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. Thus, seven times in the New Testament, Jesus said that in a certain place, there shall be the weeping and gnashing of teeth. I think sometimes people have passed over the word there, not realizing it is an adverb of place. And they think it means just simply a word that indicates the future. There shall be something. But Jesus said, there, in that place, in a specific locality, an adverb of place, there shall be the weeping and gnashing of teeth. And so he was describing what people will do in some particular place in eternity. And he said that when they experience that, those who are in that place shall experience the weeping and the gnashing of teeth as they see themselves on the outside, Luke 13, 28. And as they are agonizing in the furnace of fire, Matthew 13, 42. And as they are bound hand and foot, in another description Jesus gave, in the outer darkness, Matthew 22 and verse 13. And so here is an ongoing existence. And they're weeping and they're gnashing their teeth. He didn't say they would be doing it because of anger, but I wouldn't dispute the point. I'm sure they are angry because they're not in heaven, or because they couldn't have their own way, or because God didn't have some other eternal destiny planned for them, or because there was simply no eternal destiny. I'm sure they are going to be angry, but they are certainly going to be in pain. And when they weep and when they wail, that's not just an expression of anger. That's an expression of agony, and it's an expression of torment. And they're out there in that fire, and they're in that furnace of fire, they're in that outer darkness, they're in that unquenchable fire, and there they are going to also be with the hypocrites, Jesus said in Matthew 24 and verse 31. He didn't say they were going to be snuffed out of existence. He said they were going to be there, and they were going to be with certain other groups of people, and they were going to experience all of these things. And therefore, I want to point out to you that it does have to do with an ongoing existence, and Jesus never hinted in any of this description that it was only going to last for a time, and then it would stop. The fire was not going to stop their agony. The fire is what caused their agony. And therefore, they are in that place with the weeping and the wailing and the gnashing of teeth. And so, here we have an unending period of conscious torment. Unending conscious torment. But let us notice, beyond the words that Jesus gave, and I'm going to hope to come back to Isaiah 66. I want Brother Fudge to realize that. But in order that I might present basically the New Testament material in this particular period of time, and come back and say a little bit more about that Old Testament background and the period between the Testament, and when I get back up again. But let's hurry on to some of the other descriptions that we have in the New Testament in particular regarding final ruin, final punishment, some of the key terms that we have in the New Testament. Well, Jesus foretold in a parable that God would someday come and destroy those who killed his beloved son, Mark 12, verse 9. Now, he said that God would destroy them. However, we have to remember that he said that God was able to destroy both soul and body in hell, Matthew 10:28. He said, don't be afraid of those who can kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Brother Fudge will say there's no such thing as an immortal soul. But Jesus said when they kill the body, they cannot kill the soul. And I want to suggest to you that if you hold an annihilationist view, you probably also hold the view of soul annihilation right now while time is going on, such as these various cultic groups hold. When they teach that the body is dead and the soul passes out of existence. And let me tell you, if you can have a human being who is able to shoot a person in the heart and kill his body, and his soul thereby passes out of existence, that man has also killed the soul. But Jesus said it can't be done. And therefore the soul continues on. And it continues on in a place beyond the grave. And Luke 16 and various other passages clearly teach the ongoing existence of the soul though the body is gone. That particular passage having to do with time still in existence. Bodies in the grave, but souls still conscious. And so we have here the expression destroy. And Brother Fudge in his book says, well, of course, this would mean annihilate. It comes from the Greek word apollemi, which is found 92 times in the New Testament. But it's not translated annihilate in any passage that I'm aware of in the New Testament. And in fact, its basic meaning is not to be killed or not to pass out of existence, but rather often it is translated to lose something or to be lost in some way. And so you have in Luke 15 the parable about the lost sheep. He wasn't annihilated. He was just off in some other pasture. And this is the very same word that is used. The lost coin was not annihilated. And so here again, we have to understand that this word speaks of something that is still in existence, but it is lost somehow in some way. The prodigal son was lost, you read in Luke 15. That doesn't mean he was killed when he was off in that far country. It simply means that he was in a perishing spiritual condition. And if apollemi means annihilate, then the one who annihilates his soul or his life, Jesus said, would be the one who ends up saved. Luke 9 and verse 24. He who loses his own life or own soul for my sake shall find it. That's the very same word. And if it means annihilate, then it means annihilate there too. And Jesus is saying that suicide brings eternal life. You know as well as I do that that simply cannot be. The Theological Dictionary of the New Testament is a set of reference books that is known to a lot of people. The scholarship of the world is against Brother Fudge. This doesn't mean that everything you would read in that set of books or any other Bible encyclopedia or dictionary or what have you would be necessarily correct. But I do want to point out, since Brother Fudge mentioned that scholarship is turning more and more to his position, that these renowned reference books do not agree with what he has represented today. And in particular, in connection with this particular word, apollemi, it says that reference work says that it is definitive destruction, not merely in the sense of extinction of physical existence, but rather an eternal plunge into Hades and a hopeless destiny of death. And then we have the word perdition. It's found 20 times in the New Testament, the Greek word apoleia. It is translated perdition, destruction, damnation sometimes. The meaning, though, in connection with eternal destiny, comes out very clear in one particular passage in the New Testament. Now here again, annihilationists, and I would refer to Brother Fudge as this, though I understand he doesn't believe in immediate annihilation, it's eventual annihilation though. Annihilationists promptly usually believe that perdition, here that is mentioned in the New Testament, means absolute loss of everything, including loss of existence. And so, this is what they do with that particular term. But, when you turn over to the book of Revelation, for example, and you read about that sea beast that comes up, makes its appearance in Revelation 13, and then you go over to Revelation 17, verse 8, and also verse 11, you read that he is to go into perdition. Now, here's something very enlightening about this particular word. If that means that he is going to be annihilated, how is it then that when you get over to chapter 20, verse 10, you find that that beast is still in existence, he has not been annihilated, he is in the lake of fire and brimstone, where he is with the devil, and he is being tormented forever and ever, as that verse points out. And that is, in my estimation, as clear a demonstration as any that could be found in the New Testament to show that perdition does not mean annihilation. He was to go into perdition, but perdition meant the lake of fire and brimstone where he would be tormented in an ongoing existence. And that is the meaning of the word when it comes to people as well. All others headed for perdition will suffer that very same fate. I noticed Brother Fudge didn't refer to Revelation 17 or this particular connection in his book. It is not the loss of consciousness, but it is the loss of happiness and the loss of blessedness that's being discussed here. And then also the word destruction, which is found in our versions, translated from the Greek word olathros, another Greek term that is found in the New Testament. Well, it's similar to the one we just talked about. And we have this word, again, represented by annihilationist sanguis, means that people are simply going to pass out of existence. But that, again, is not the case. You read also in the New Testament, in the words of Paul, that those who have a love for riches, the inordinate love for money, will drown men in destruction and perdition. It doesn't mean that people who have a craving for money have a tendency to fall out of boats and drown in lakes. It does mean that they lose their spiritual sensitiveness to God's will, and they tend to turn away from God. And so here is a person who goes into destruction, but this, when it is referring to the soul's condition or the soul's destiny, does not wipe out that person, because again, when Jesus comes again, there's going to be that sudden destruction. 1 Thessalonians 5:3, and yet all will stand before the judgment seat of Christ. If that means sudden annihilation, then nobody who is wicked is going to stand before his judgment seat. Nobody's going to receive any torment at all. And therefore, we understand that destruction here simply means a destruction of the soul's saved state. It is not the destruction of one's being, but it is the destruction of one's well-being. And so to go on, the word punishment. We have the word eternal, or the term eternal punishment, Matthew 25 and verse 46. Punishment is rendered from the Greek word kolosis in the Greek New Testament. Arne Gingrich also called it torture, by the way. Some have said, well, this is only the result of some kind of punishment, but Thayer as well, not only using torture from Arne Gingrich, but also Thayer, he says that it refers to those who suffer, that it has to do with chastisement, this again from the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, and it has to do with ongoing punishments. And therefore, when you come to eternal punishment, when Jesus said the wicked shall go away into eternal punishment, he's talking about an eternal suffering. And the word eternal would indicate that the suffering would last as long as the eternal life of the righteous. Matthew 25, 46. But the Fudge will not agree with that. He will say that only speaks of result, not action. But the word punishment indicates something that is happening that is an experience, not just the result, not just being snuffed out. You take the verb form, for example. 2 Peter 2:9, God knows how to keep the unrighteous under punishment under the day of judgment. Here they are, he's keeping them there, they are reserved there, they are still there, they are under punishment. It is something that is ongoing. It is not simply a momentary punishment and then all is over with. And Peter is saying, therefore, that God keeps the unrighteous in a constant state of punishment between death and judgment day. That's the reference, the frame of reference that Peter had in mind. And just ascending angels are reserved or kept in pits of darkness, as Peter said, 2 Peter 2:4, Jude verse 6. Then also lost people are being kept under punishment in the place or in the state of Hades. And then, finally, after judgment day, these will go away into eternal punishment. Matthew 25, 46. And they go, therefore, into that place of gloom or darkness, which has been kept or reserved for them forever. 2 Peter 2:17 and Jude, verse 13. Now the word eternal comes up for mention a lot of times in these discussions. 70 times in the Greek New Testament, you have the word aionios, alone. And there are other forms or cognates to it, ion, and there are various ones. But this word is especially embarrassing to annihilationists, and they try to explain it away because eternal sounds like it's not going to come to an end, and therefore they go to great lengths to try to make it out to be something that is not necessarily everlasting. You read about eternal fire, eternal punishment, eternal destruction as the result of eternal judgment, and you put all that together, and it sounds like an unending, everlasting form of punishment. But those who take the annihilationist position have to try to get out of that in some way. And so they go to explaining away the word ionios. And they say, well, it only speaks of a quality of life or a different sphere of life, not in the temporal realm, but in another realm. Or they say it refers to the results rather than the action. And I think, if I remember correctly, Brother Phelps tried both of those arguments in his book. And I would like to suggest, by the way, that you can't hold both of them at the same time. It's either talking about an everlasting result or it's talking about something in a different sphere, and if you hold both of those positions, they contradict themselves. But nevertheless, as we go on, here again, the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament says this term ionios is used as a term for eschatological expectation, having to do with the last things, judgment, day, the second coming of Christ, heaven, hell, and all of that. And that if it conveys eternity for the rewards of the righteous, it must also, in the passages that we have just noticed, back up here where you have eternal fire, eternal punishment, eternal destruction, eternal judgment. And I won't give you all the references because we don't have the time for all of that. But in those passages, this book says that it must necessarily convey the same sense of unceasing or endless. The New International Dictionary of New Testament Theology, a very recent work that has just come out, agrees again and says the New Testament speaks of eternity in categories of time. George Eldon Ladd, another popular writer and theologian that has produced a theology of the New Testament and various other books, says that ionios does not carry a qualitative significance, that the meaning of the word is temporal, that when it is used of fire and punishment of sin, it's talking about unending, everlasting. And therefore, I don't believe it would be correct for anyone holding the annihilationist position to come back and say the scholarship of the world is on our side, that ionios, eternal, does not mean everlasting. These books indicate that it does. And besides that, 141 times inspired writers used the two terms ion and ionios in the New Testament to speak about eternity and the eternal existence that all of us are going to face. All other synonyms used of our eternal existence are found less than 20 times in the New Testament. And as a matter of fact, the terms unceasing, endless, or perpetual, those three terms are never found at all when speaking of our eternal existence. And that demonstrates one thing. I'm talking about for the righteous or the wicked. It demonstrates one thing, that in the mind of God Himself, in the usage of inspired writers, the terms ion and ionios, ionios, commonly translated eternal or everlasting, conveyed in the best possible sense as God viewed it, the unending existence of the righteous, and since the term was also used for the wicked, it conveyed the very same sense. This is how inspiration has presented itself to us. Many have tried to manipulate these terms, but they have manipulated them in order to evade plain declarations of Scripture. The New Testament presents to us that the wicked certainly are going to have an eternal, unending, conscious state of existence. I'm going to stop right here and not present further material because my time is about up. Possibly in the last segment, we will notice a few more things that the New Testament has to say in particular about how the people are going to be disposed of on that last great day. But I want you to listen very carefully, Brother Fudge, and I consider him a worthy man to present his view. He is certainly a fine fellow, a gentleman, as all can observe. I count it a privilege to have a part in this discussion. And I want you to listen carefully to him and then to my rebuttal, which will follow. Thank you.